Oh, good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop on this Fine Food Friday, January 19th. I'm Ray Graff. Today we're flipping through the history books with the help of some liquid intelligence. The good folks from the Albany Ale Project are here to discuss suds, spirits, and their latest foray into the Capital Region's beer and liquor history. If you have a question about the lineage of Albany booze, give us a call at 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Ale, Pilsner, Stouts. Your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. On this Food Friday, we delve into the beer and liquor history books with members of the Albany Ale Project. The project's Craig Gravina is here, joined by Johnny Curtin of the Albany Distilling Company and Scott Veltman of the C.H. Evans Brewing Company at the Albany Pump Station and Indian Ladder Farm and Cidery. Always great to have these guys on hand because they always bring presents. Our number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Craig, Johnny, Scott, welcome to Food Friday.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
You guys are in a good mood.
We are. The beer's here, so we're even better mood.
You brought beer. And again, the number is 800-348-2551. Well done, Zach the engineer. Yes, pot the music up. And the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. This project of yours, how does Proust figure into it?
So Proust is, it's an event that we're doing, the three of us are doing with Discover Albany. And they've got a program right now that is, they call it Savor Albany.
Okay.
And it's like a year-long special events where they get together with like historic houses and they're having like walking tours and demonstrations. So Proust is sort of our homage to 1790s Albany.
Oh,
so
cool.
We're going to talk about like how alcohol affected the culture in Albany and how some of the beer was made and how some of the spirits were made. And we're focusing, this one, we're at Ten Broke Mansion. We're focusing on strong beer and rum.
Oh,
so
what could go wrong?
I know, exactly. Right.
Well, this is great. Craig, you've done a lot of research over the years on brewing around here and around the whole region. What have you learned in your investigations into 1790s Albany brewing culture as opposed to, say, 1850?
Well, the way I kind of look at it is it's sort of the jumping off point where it's after the Revolution. You know, the old school Dutch brewers who were sort of dominant in the 17th and 18th century are sort of waning. They're diversifying. They're going off and doing their farms and everything. And you're getting this influx of English and Scottish brewers coming in, and they're really sort of setting the stage for what will become Albany Ale, you know, this phenomenon of the 1850s.
This is very interesting, and again, I mentioned this in the green room before the program. Somehow my internet journey took me to the creation of Albany Ale this week, and it really was an actual thing. It sort of was well known.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, tell us about Albany Ale and what it was.
So, you know, they've been brewing in this area for 400 years.
Right.
And Albany Ale was this phenomenon that starts, you know, right around 1800. Like it was Albany was exporting a lot of beer. It was and as time goes on, you start seeing more and more and more of it to the point where Albany had the largest brewery in the country, had a couple of the largest breweries in the country.
And they were making double X, strong stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Like that was what they were known for, was strong beer. But they were also known for being able to export it, right? So you could have raw ingredients in the western part of the state, you know, barley and hops coming down the Erie Canal. And this is in the 1850s. And the beer was made in Albany and then shipped to New York City and everywhere. We've seen Albany Ale in Hawaii in the late 1840s and early 1850s.
It's a long journey for a bottle of beer.
Yeah, it's
we well know, it doesn't travel all that well.
It's actually further to go from Albany to Hawaii than it is to go from England to India. So, you know, like
it's a lot closer.
Yeah, maybe it's America's IPA.
Oh, there you go. All
right, capitalize on IPA.
All right, jumping back a few years to the 1790s. You have made a special beer for this event.
Yeah, we did, what was it, James Boyd?
Yeah.
James Boyd, it was a 1798 recipe where it's 50% barley, 25% wheat, 25% rye. We used some Helderberg hops, which are native to this area. They're originally grown in Knox, New York, where I'm from. And then Dietrich Gehring over at Indian Ladder started making, growing quite a bit of this heritage hop, which he calls Helderberg. There was a guy named Dan Driscoll, who was like a hop pioneer, I guess you could say, for this area. And he still had these rhizomes still on his family's farm. And he decided to bring them down to Dieter, and Dieter grew them commercially. So we used those hops in there. And it's actually fermented with bread yeast.
And that's uncommon?
That was very common, I believe,
back
in
then.
The day.
But not now.
Not now. Yeah.
Back then, yeast was yeast.
Yeah.
It was.
Bakers used to get yeast from brewers. So, and the beer that we made is sort of inspired by this James Boyd. It's not really a recipe. We have a couple pages from his ledger, and we can see how much grain he was buying. And they break it down in those percentages of 50% barley, 25% wheat, 25% rye. Prior to the 1790s, there's a big push in the 1790s to start growing barley for malting. Before that, it was oats and wheat, and that's like what strong Dutch beer in 1690 would have been made out of, a combination of wheat and oats or not barley.
Right.
It would have been whatever they had extra, right?
Right, whatever they had in hand, they would make out. And if they could get a barley crop to grow, they'd use that.
They use a lot of molasses,
yeah,
too.
And they also, they liked wheat beer. But this is that transition period in the 1790s where things are starting to change. So we based the recipe on this James Boyd 1798 ledger.
So you're guesstimating based on what he purchased.
There are very, very few brewing records from the 18th century. There might be some English ones and there might be some German ones, but there's almost none for American. There's a George Washington small beer recipe, but it's just after scientific brewing takes off, right? So the thermometer is only 25 years old at this point, right?
Witchcraft.
Yeah, and everything. Yeah, everything's sort of word of mouth and just passed
down.
Rule
of thumb.
Yeah.
Johnny from the Albany Distilling Company, what have you brought to add to this 1790s vibe?
So honestly, I kind of cheated because I'm already using the 1750s ish era recipe for my rum. So
I will not stand for that. By the way.
Yeah. Oh God.
The
1750s.
So. Right. State-of-the-art rum recipe is pretty much as it was.
Yeah, it's you take water and molasses and mix it. This is before hydrometers and all those sorts of wizardry. And the way that they determined the correct density of the molasses solution, which is called a wash, is by floating a raw egg in it. So you take water, you put a raw egg into that water, and you just add molasses until the egg floats.
You didn't bring any raw eggs, did you?
I have several.
I've been through some bad times drinking raw eggs.
The eggs are for if you say anything that really, not you, but when Craig starts to really,
it's for my workout.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
All right, let's take a call here before we take our first break. Our number is 800-348-2551. Beer and spirits today on the program. Let's go to Jen in Bolton. Jen, you're on.
Hi there. I have traveled quite a bit and stopping at breweries all along the way. On the West Coast, I noticed the dark beers are very hearty. There's a lot to them. You can practically like bite into them. They're amazing and wonderful. And then I come back home and everything is kind of dull. And I don't know, they say it's thick, but it's really not. The reason why we tend to focus more on hops here on the East Coast, or I don't know, it's what it seems like to me.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Do you find that true? I found many a meaty beer here.
Absolutely, especially here on the East Coast. We do have a lot of beers that are very light in body compared to the West Coast beers, where we're just focusing more on hop aroma and hop flavor opposed to hop bitterness and big malt forward beers. So that's pretty interesting.
And before Prohibition,
I mean, I've promised you here, like at Adirondack, the Fat Scotsman, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
But it's still not the same. I don't know.
I mean, New York State before Prohibition was the, you know, the hop capital of the world, right?
Right before the 30s, I believe, until the blight came through.
80% of the hops grown in the United States in 1880 were grown in New York State.
And that stopped, and it's coming back.
It's not to that level. I mean, even if you look at British brewing records of the late 19th century, you're seeing that they're buying American and specifically New York hops pretty regularly. That stops with World War I because, you know, they need to send corn and other things to England, and their boats were being sunk as well. That had something to do with it. But yeah, New York was a major hops producer up until about 1912, 1914. They had a blight and an aphid infestation and a couple of things kind of.
And then Prohibition was sort of the death knell, death blow rather, yeah.
But as a stylistic point, the amount of hops, the amount of bitterness, the amount of malt forwardness is a very cyclical thing. I mean, I'm a little older than you guys, but I remember Newman brewing beer that was, his winter ale was a very meaty beer. It was great stuff.
And what comes around goes around, too. I just saw somebody made like a New England style IPA. You know, and typically when you think IPA, you think of a bitter beer. New England IPAs are sort of juicy and, you know, traditionally, they've been around for like a year and a half.
Yeah. Right.
They're cloudy, but somebody put one out that has zero IBUs in it. So it has.
Now, what is an IBU for those?
IBU is sort of a weird way to measure bitterness in beer.
Yeah, it's the International Bittering Unit.
Yeah. So
there is such a thing?
Yeah. So Hetty Topper is
I must
like
be off the charts.
Hetty Topper is like 125 IBUs, and this other beer, which is supposedly the same style, is zero IBUs.
Is that a subjective measurement, though? Or is that how is
that's my question. How does one actually do that? neither one knows.
Stump the brewers.
Yeah, right.
Leave it to the booze guy to come up with a good question.
Right? Yeah.
All right, let's take a break here. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. We talk beer, we talk spirits, and your call is coming up.
Support for WAMC comes from Harold's Ice Cream, Thorne's Marketplace, Old South Street, downtown Northampton, Massachusetts. Dairy and no moo dairy free, handmade artisan ice cream, sweet baked goods, hot fudge, and more. Harold's.com. Blue Heron Restaurant and Catering, offering full service catering at the restaurant in Sunderland and throughout western Massachusetts. BlueHeronDining.com/catering. Pekarsky's, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, family owned since 1948. Offering sausages from kielbasa to Italian to bratwurst and smoked meats, home of New England farm-made sausage, open 7 days, Pekarskys.com. And Berkshire Country Day, an independent pre-K to 9 school, comprehensive curriculum, and an emphasis on community, now enrolling for fall 2018, intentional, independent, inspired, BerkshireCountryDay.org.
Vox Pop on WAMC Food Friday. Ray Graff here with you at 800-348-2551. We're joined by Craig Gravina today of the Albany Ale Project, joined by Johnny Curtin of the Albany Distilling Company and Scott Veltman of the C.H. Evans Brewing Company. A couple of quick emails before we get back to the discussion and the phone calls. This one's from Ted in Slingerland. What's the advantage / difference of cold brewed beer? Why should we care? I see advertisements for cold brewed. What does it mean? That's from Ted. Why are you laughing, Mr. Brewer?
Well, how do you cold brew? That's the main reason.
Okay.
Usually use steam, and usually brew in steam.
Right.
So hot. About, like, so hot all the time.
It's just a marketing gimmick, right, basically.
So you can't brew cold.
Well, doesn't some yeast ferment better cold?
Yeah, like
lagering yeast.
Lagering yeast does. Yeah. But when you're brewing it, it's hot.
Yeah.
When you're fermenting, it's a little cold. And then when you crash the tank out, so you turn on your glycol, and then it drops all everything out, and then makes it easier to be filtered. So when they say cold filtered,
right,
every beer is cold filtered,
so if
it's filtered.
If the huge brewing concern from the West wants to sue you. What's the email address?
Yeah, right.
All right, this one's from Eric. I'm actively in the design and funding stage of starting a small-scale brewing endeavor and want to use all New York ingredients. I have a local source for malted barley. What are the hops varieties in the Hudson Valley, and are they available to someone like me who only needs a relatively small amount? All right, before we do that, is the hops scare over? Is the big hops shortage now done? Yeah. Are we past that?
Yep. Yeah.
All right, so where can Eric find hops in relatively small amounts? What varieties are available around here?
There's a lot of farms. Yeah. There's a lot of farms. You know, like, the hops industry is still, you know, still growing. There's still some infrastructure that needs to happen.
Pun intended? Is that a...
Pun fully intended.
That was terrible.
So, I know. It's always, the puns are always bad.
Yeah. The problem is you guys are sober. I think it's probably much funnier. About 8 o'clock at night, 9 o'clock. Anyway, go on.
Right. There's a whole bunch of places. I mean, there's a lot of just like hobby hops farms now. So there's a lot of places that are just, you know, they found some wild hops and they started to cultivate them and growing them. So they're available. There's really a good number of places that are doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of where you can. I know there's a website. I believe it's Source New York.
Source New York.
Yeah.
Source New York.
Okay. That's good. Find... Source New York.
Yeah. Yeah.
Source NY.
Yeah. Yeah.
There are a great variety of hops, and many beers and ales will use different hops. Why do they? They're hops. Why do they taste different? Why would one hop?
Different types of oils. Why would, that are
in other words, if I drink a Titan IPA, mm-hmm. it's very piney. Why are the hops different in that?
Just the variety of hops, because they have different types of hop oils. Their alpha acids are different, so alpha.
But aren't hops? This is my point.
What's like dogs? Yeah, poodles. You got your labs.
It's like an apple. You know, I mean, you know, growers are making hops taste the way, you know, they're selecting them for different, you know, pineapple flavor or bitterness, and like Cascade's going to have a lot more of that pine flavor than like Citra. Citra's going to have more of a, you know, like a citrusy, orangey sort of flavor, you know, and you know, it used to be you'd have a, you know, 10 varieties of hops, and you'd have to sort of cull those flavors out of the malt, or you'd have to, you know, actually add caramel or something like that to get different flavors, or use hops and sort of rate their bitterness at different levels. Now, I mean, there's so many different ingredients that are being used in beer, so many different things, so many more things that are just acceptable to do that, you know.
Give me an example.
You know, like, I think the most, the grossest one.
All right,
would be
I didn't say the grossest one, but all right, if you want to go there, that's fine.
The sheep testicle.
All right, that's it.
Right? Exactly.
All right, carry on.
And let's go to the phone. Yeah.
Before we do that, Scott Veltman, tell me about the beer you brought.
Oh, yeah. So, we have Dr. Paul is Not a Poodle, which is funny you're talking about dogs. It's a collaboration beer between us, which is C.H. Evans Brewing Company, Indian Ladder Farms, and KCBC Brewing Company, which is out of Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah.
This is all made with New York State malt, which is actually malted in right here in Albany at Convergence Malt. Right over off of Central.
It's got a beautiful taste. It's,
yeah.
There are hops, but it has some sweetness, and it's fairly light. You could probably drink a few of these and be okay.
Yeah, it's 6.42%.
Light.
Yeah, it's light. It's a session beer.
Now, I can see C.H. Evans and Indian Ladder in this partnership to make this. How did the Brooklyn Company get involved?
Well, that's actually really funny because Indian Ladder has close ties to Brooklyn. They sell a lot of their cider down there.
Really?
Yep. And... They've been in contact with a lot of these Brooklyn breweries, such as Innerborough and Other Half, Threes, and then KCBC, and just kind of build this relationship with these guys down in the city, because a lot, like up here, there's not a lot of people that know who KCBC is, you know?
I can see doing certain things. With a long distance partnership, if you're working on a song and there's a musician in California, you want him to play on it, that's fine. When you're making a beer, how do you collaborate on a beer with somebody in Brooklyn who's down the Hudson River?
Well, you have them come up.
Yeah,
because we brewed this right.
Well,
or we go down there.
I mean, the other thing is too is you know, places like Indian Ladder and the farm brewery movement. You know, the places that are actually operating farms that are growing grain and they're growing hops. there's a natural connection right there. Like if you have a place in New York City that is using New York State grown ingredients, well, they're going to contact the farm. The farm also has a brewery. Hey, let's get together. Let's create a recipe and let's, you know, let's
try to make 100% New York State beer.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, this one isn't. It has experimental hops in it from...
Experimental hops.
Yep, from West Coast out in Yakima.
What makes them experimental?
They're just been bred through a program through Hopsteiner, and they actually have no name. It actually just has a number, so it's experimental hop 10419.
Huh.
Such a shame.
It's catchy.
Nameless hop.
You know, the distiller has been very quiet.
I know.
This
I know.
Whole project, this project.
And that's the way it should be.
You like that. Now, as I understand it, this whole project between Craig and Johnny and Scott began with an argument on Facebook. Explain.
Yeah.
Craig was wrong. I mean, it's that. It's
all right.
First of all, Craig is never wrong.
All right.
So Deanna Fox, who happens to be our moderator at the Proust event.
Which is when, by the way?
It's next Saturday, the 27th.
Okay.
And I think it's 7 to 9?
It's sold out.
At the Tenbrook Mansion.
Yeah, Tenbrook Mansion.
Okay.
And, so she's great because she's going to be able to ask us questions. She actually has a background in food history and stuff. So she's perfect for this.
Not at a loss for words, either.
Yeah, right. Me neither. So she wrote an article about rum, right? It was
So when we first started off, five and a half years ago, the intention was to make whiskey, and that's because of the Farm Distilling Act. And through that, since whiskey's made from grain, New York grows plenty of grain. It was an easy sort of it was a pretty solid fit. You know?
Yeah.
So. That was the original plan, and then once we finally got the space, which is, you know, next door to the pump station, we learned that about 10 years earlier they had discovered the original distillery that was in Albany. So where we are now, where the pump station is now, used to be right near the edge of the Hudson River.
Yeah.
But when they dredged out the canal, they infilled, you know, acres and acres of the river to make more Albany. But in doing so. So a few things happened sort of concurrently. First of all, post-revolution, the British sort of high society fell out of fashion, and rum was very much associated with that. So rum declined pretty rapidly following the, you know, the turn of the century. So the Quackenbush Dow Distillery opened in the 1750s and closed up sometime around, say, 1810 or so.
Okay.
So they just mothballed this distillery. And then they dredged out the canal and just buried it because it, you know, it's just these wooden vats that, you know, probably drowning hazard or whatever.
Sure.
I mean, people died all kinds of crazy ways back
then.
Sure. So they forgot about it, and then when they dug the parking garage, they rediscovered it. And we were like, all right, we're 50 yards from this colonial rum distillery. We have a distillery. Like we'd be remiss not to make rum.
Sure.
So that was sort of the
did you use the old vats?
We tried. They're in the New York State Museum.
Yeah,
we
did.
Really?
We
engineered a heist, and Craig caught us, and that's where our.
So anyway, the fight. Now we have to get back to the phones. Sure, I have a feeling this conversation could go into the evening. How did the actual fight take place?
Deanna wrote an article about rum in general, and was talking about. Albany Distilling Company and the Quackenbush House or Quackenbush Stillhouse rum, and I got on and said beer was more popular than rum and
back in those days.
I may be wrong. I mean there was a lot of booze drank.
No, I think so, like overall, yeah, there's more beer. Beer is more popular in general.
Right.
You can drink more beer too.
Right, but I think something that I was really talking about was the. Like in context, in the middle of the 18th century, it was the Seven Years' War, French Indian War. British soldiers were given a rum ration.
Sure.
And so having a rum factory inland, this far inland, made it sort of a
you get rum to the frontier really easy.
Yes. Yeah. And keep your soldiers happy. Yeah. And so it's kind of an outpost for.
And the long and short of it is. Neither one of us are right in this argument.
Yeah,
that's not true.
And we were both right.
Yeah,
you know, right into the microphone.
You know what this really shows me? This really shows me you both have a lot of time on your hands.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But the thing is that beer and rum were very, very popular.
Okay.
In the end of the 18th century.
You know, let's drink some rum.
That sounds like a
I'll take a call.
Idea.
You dispense the rum. Right. Pamela and Troy. Pamela, you're on. Hello? She probably left. Are you there, Pamela? I think she's there. She may have fallen asleep.
Pam!
Do you blame her?
Let's put her back on hold. Yeah, I know. That scintillating conversation about the argument. All right, Pam, try it again. Our number is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Food and spirits on a Food Friday. And we have Craig Gravina here, Johnny Curtin, and Scott Veltman. And what do we have here, Johnny Curtin?
So, as I was saying, I kind of cheated because we already used the 18th century rum recipe. I have two iterations. The first one, the clear one, is rum, which is pretty similar to how it would have been produced and consumed during colonial times.
So, okay.
So, generally speaking, rum now, you know, sort of larger scale commercial rums are distilled to, you know, 90% alcohol, and the flavor comes over with the water, with the remaining 10%, mm-hmm. and they'll distill it two or three times to really. I mean, I'm exceptionally biased, but it really sort of dulls the flavor.
Okay.
Whereas this is a single distillation, and I usually distill it anywhere from 75 to 83%. So mm-hmm. you're still getting, which, you know, that 25% doesn't sound like a lot, but it does bring quite a bit of flavor over. So you still get this really earthy, very molasses-forward flavor, and this is similar to what they would have been drinking.
The clear one.
The clear one.
Very tasty. Right.
Thank you. A lot of butterscotch.
It's not an ale, but it's good.
Nobody's perfect.
And you know, both beer and rum were like heavily traded. They were almost like currency.
Sure.
It wasn't uncommon. You see, like Sir William Johnson in the mid 18th century in Johnstown trading and opening up trade routes between central New York and New York City and pushing both rum and beer back and forth. He controlled the market.
Sure. Darker rum.
So the darker rum is.
It's not very dark.
It's not very dark, and that's actually because it's a used barrel. So the barrels for whiskey we use fresh charred oak,
mm-hmm.
and that strips most of the color out of it. So when I reuse the barrels, the char itself has been mostly removed. Tannins have been mostly removed. What's left is what are called the vanillins, which are what happens when you toast oak. So you can leave the rum in there without worrying about it being bittered by the tannins and the char. And still soak up all those remaining vanillins from the leftover from the first use.
That's really good, by the way.
Which one?
The amber.
So you didn't like the other one?
No, I did.
Okay.
Wow,
I think
Craig,
I like
that's
this
really,
one.
That's
just
checking.
Tasty.
I didn't like either one of them.
Right. And this is really sort of, you know, our expression of it. This is aged for 2 years.
Oh, I love this.
And back in the day, rum or just spirits in general were not aged intentionally. They were aged just as a matter of transportation.
You know, sure.
Think about making a barrel 200 years ago. You have to find an oak tree somewhere in the mountains. You got to get a couple of big burly, like two of Scott, to saw it down. And then you got to strip off all the limbs. You know, just getting the wood itself is a process. You have to float it to a mill somewhere. It has to be quarter sawn, which even with modern technology is a pain.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, like I can go on and on. So barrels were hugely expensive, and so there were these very utilitarian, reused over and over, and so you wouldn't get much wood character back then unless it was being transported for a long distance.
It's really fantastic stuff. And what is the name of the more golden rum that we just drank?
So we just call it the amber rum. Quackenbush is the name of both rums.
Really nice. Really nice.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been.
Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551, the number. And Pamela is back with us in Troy. Pamela, you're on.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Yeah, I've got sort of a pet peeve that's developed recently.
Oh, good.
Is it with Johnny?
No. It's Craig.
I love that we have so many styles of craft beer available. But in the rush to try the latest trendy thing, people seem to have drifted away from some of the old standbys. And just recently I stopped in a new place and asked for something in the mid-range, an amber, a pale ale, a brown ale, something of that sort. And they had nothing but IPAs and a coffee stout, which they were out of.
Yeah.
And some sours, which I can't stand, and some fruity stuff, which I don't care for. and I'd like to put in a plea for brewers and both and also places that serve beers to just serve some good medium ales.
I'm with you. I'm with you, Pamela. I'm glad you called back. All right, experts, what do you think?
I think that's a great idea because right now, as she's saying, like, you know, the market's being flooded with all these IPAs and
all this
crazy
trendy
beers.
Stuff.
I have a feeling it's going to go back to, like, the traditional styles, even back to, like, Pilsners.
Get me a good Albany Ale, a double X. Get me one.
Right. Yeah.
I enjoy an IPA, but sometimes I just want something right there in the middle. And also the ABV is way too high on some of this stuff. You can only have one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I prefer beers that are in, you know, the 4 to 6 range because you can actually enjoy more than one.
Yeah.
So it's like Schaefer beer.
Yeah. In the 1850s, you're talking about high ABV. In the 1850s, Albany Ale was anywhere between 9.5% and 13%.
Perfect. That's a nice light beer.
Right. Get you where you need to be.
But that helped it travel. There were some practical considerations there, too, or no?
It's funny. The stuff that seems to travel the furthest distance actually went in bottles. You know, I've heard a couple of different things. I've heard, like, IPA was, like, sort of 6%. You wanted it to ferment all the way out, so you didn't have a lot of live yeast in it. But then you have, you know, Arctic Ale that came out at the end of the 19th century, which was pretty high-octane stuff. Albany Ale was pretty high-octane. I've heard so many different things. I don't know if I could put my finger on saying, yes, that's why it was.
But
I think that people just like strong ale.
Right.
And I think that Albany became known for its strong ale. I know so. I don't think so. I know that that's...
And just going back, I think the reason I'm being so quiet is because I don't know much about beer. And I want to give the audience opportunity to ask questions. But as far as hops go, was it similar to how... You know, the beer recipes were decided. It was whatever hops were growing at that time they'd throw in, or was it more intentional?
No, you know, it depends. Like in the 1850s, you know, they were putting in hot. So we were talking about aging rum.
Mm-hmm.
Beer before 1850 was most of it was aged.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you know they were using hops for the bitterness and also as a preservative because it's perfect for that.
Right.
Most of the hops in the 1790s were coming from Massachusetts. Like, they're not commercially growing hops in New York. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen until, like, 1808, and New York City doesn't get their first New York-grown hops until 1816.
Oh, interesting.
And it booms from there, you know, like, really, by the 1850s, 1860s.
We need to take just a fast break here. We're joined today by Scott Veltman, Johnny Curtin, and Craig Gravina, and we welcome your calls. We'll get back to the phones in a minute. I promise those who have been waiting, 800-348-2551 is the number.
Support for WMC comes from Troy Waterfront Farmers Market, featuring over 80 local farms and fresh food vendors every week all winter long. Open every Saturday, 9 to 2, in the Troy Atrium, troymarket.org. Silver Bay YMCA Conference and Family Retreat Center on Lake George, New York. Open to all for family reunions, conferences, and personal retreats, silverbay.org. Cafe Capriccio, Chef Jim Rua, working to preserve and maintain the traditions of Italian cuisine and hospitality since 1982 on Grand Street in Albany, New York. CafeCapriccio.com. And Big Elm Brewing. Tap room open Thursday through Saturdays, noon to 6 p.m. Crafting ales and lagers in Sheffield, Massachusetts since 2012. BigElmBeer.com.
Big event is Proust, something or other, Albany history of ale, and it's...
something or other.
I don't know. It's next week. It's sold out, really. Deanna Fox will be there.
We've been sampling for a half hour now.
Tenbrook Mansion,
yeah.
Monday.
Can I give a
no?
A
Wednesday?
It's Saturday.
It's got information.
You can show up on Wednesday.
What's the website?
The website is www.albany.org/restaurants, and that'll take you to the Savor Albany...
Okay.
blah, blah, blah.
The thing is sold out, but you can still learn some important things, like about this great brandy that we had during the break. Mm-hmm. And do, Johnny, tell us about the brandy.
I mean, the brandy I brought just as sort of an aperitif. This presumably would have...
An aperitif to...
two shots
of rum and beer.
And a pint of beer. No,
just go with the flow.
Just in case the conversation drifted that way. So as we're discussing earlier, the British really had a dramatic influence on colonial culture, and that's reflected in the rum. But brandy would have been around before that. So just kind of a window into the what sort of led to the rum.
Yeah. Well, that's good stuff.
And you know, like, our conversation was like, who, when we were arguing on Deanna's Facebook page.
The one time we've ever argued.
Right. We hugged just now.
All right, fine.
But it was like, who was drinking what and when were they drinking? And what it comes down to is, like I said, everybody was just drinking. They would drink whatever they had. You know,
well, you didn't
Dutch
really want to drink the water.
Yeah, right. Yeah, whiskey was safer than water. Yeah. It was cheaper than wine or coffee. People would have a shot of whiskey in the morning instead of coffee.
And especially like in Dutch culture, like they were a drinking culture. Yeah. The people that settled in Fort Orange and Beverwijk, they were, you know, sailors that were coming over here. They weren't like the pilgrims that were coming over for religious freedom. They were coming over here for the beaver trade. So when they got done, you know, tanning beaver hides, they wanted
it. It was Hedrick time.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Greg in Albany. Greg, you're on.
Hey.
Hey.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
So,
hi, Greg.
In light of some of the earlier questions here, I was wondering, has there ever been anybody you know or to redo any of the Stanton beers?
Stanton beers.
Stanton was a Troy brewery. No. Stanton is actually, the history of that brewery, they started as Abraham Nash in like 1860. And that 1816, and that brewery operated all the way up until the early 1950s.
Okay.
So, I mean, they were one of the long-standing breweries in this area.
Is that the one across from the Hadley Building? It's like a U-Haul now?
No, it's gone. It burned.
All right.
Fitzgerald Brothers and Stanton had both closed, but they burned like a year apart, 63, 64. Yeah. You know, that brewery was lost to the ages. It was never bought by a major brewery. There's no records that I know of that exist from that brewery. The closest thing you could do would be maybe recreate a post-prohibition light lager or a cream ale, but that would just be a crapshoot.
Okay.
You know, it's... Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking of that, around the holidays, around Thanksgiving, I had a chance. I was given a six-pack of the Budweiser Prohibition. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a throwback in that it's very light, and it was not horrible. Different than usually you have a beer where a lot of character, but this is just a good drinking beer. It's sort of a throwback
sessionable
beer.
Yeah. We figure. I mean, Prohibition saw. I mean, I'm more of a spirits person, so
you know, to a
hammer, everything's a nail. But Prohibition saw a lot of drinking culture transformed, and one of the big things that we've benefited from in the long term is cocktails. Things were designed to be consumed quickly, surreptitiously. I'm sure it's apocryphal, but you know, if there's a raid, you want to be able to slam your beer back and leave. So you saw a trend towards easier drinking cocktails and beers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Prohibition really affected the beer industry more than the spirits industry. You know, in order for beer to be profitable, you have to make it at some scale.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You can make liquor at a smaller scale and cut it, which is what the bootleggers did. I mean, you're making booze. They'll make a high-octane whatever, and then cut it with water, cut it with other things, and you know, quadruple what they're doing. But Prohibition really cut into beer production, and it allowed for the beer industry that we think of today, like the big lager beer industry that we think today, is a direct result of Prohibition.
But this was, I guess, a 1933, a post-Prohibition recipe.
Yeah.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll go to Bill in Hudson. Bill.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm calling from Hudson, where I get my favorite beer at the Spotty Dog, the pump station by Evan. And a few things I'd I'd like to hear about, if possible, from your Evans rep there. Is there any history to the pump station brand that you make, or the flavor that you make?
With the brown ale?
The pump station.
Mm. Okay.
Yeah, there's no history with that. It's not really a historical beer. Once in a great while, we will bring back one of the original Evans beers, which was Old Musty, which is a barley wine that clocks in around 12%.
Evans was 1786?
Yeah, 1786 is when they started, and it was in Hudson.
Evans buys it in the 1860s, but the brewery opened in 1786. Mm-hmm. But we, Scott and Ryan, who used to work there, we've made a couple of Albany ales.
Yeah, we made three.
Three.
Well, thank you, Bill, for that. How many breweries were there in Albany at the absolute peak of Albany brewing?
So Albany Ale is not specific just to Albany. It's the upper Hudson Valley are making this style of Albany Ale. They may start advertising it as Poughkeepsie Ale or Hudson Ale.
Okay, but that's not what I asked. I asked how many breweries were there in Albany at one time at the peak.
I know, but I've got to throw a caveat. Classic Craig. Right? Right. I would make a good...
It depends how you define brewery.
Politician. So there were about... In the 1850s?
Back to the phones.
All right, let him talk. If I have to stop this show.
I'm so glad I'm between you guys.
Yeah. All right, Craig, go ahead. Over to you.
So let's say 20 to 30 in Albany, probably another 20 in Troy.
Really?
Yeah. You're looking at a time frame from the height, 1825 to 1870. You know, it ebbs and flows. Sometimes you have more, sometimes you have less. But all said and done, probably 40 or 50 in the upper Hudson Valley.
Wow, that's amazing. But Albany was still a happening brewing town right up until the Midwestern giants took over, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things that happened at the end of the 19th century. The railroads really, you know, the Erie Canal really made it easy for Albany to be able to distribute its beer. When the railroads sort of proliferate, then any little town can get a brewery and they can get materials in and out. That's when you start to see the wane.
The refrigeration too.
You have the popularity of lager growing. I mean, there were lager breweries that opened in Albany. There were a lot that opened in Troy. What ends up happening is you start seeing conglomeration of some of the large ale breweries. Lager has a tough time getting going in Albany because it can't compete with the large ale breweries. Huh. So
people like stronger beer. In Albany.
Yeah.
Troy, they like the lighter beer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Quite obviously. Right. Let's go back to the phones here, and we'll go to Mike in Huntington, Mass. Mike, you're on.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I love your program.
Good, man. Nice to have you here.
Yeah. Well, you guys are talking about flavored beers.
Yeah.
And I have a nephew that grows his own hops, and he grows it in Huntington, and he takes it out to Pittsfield. And he makes his own beer. He makes it with raspberry juice and ginger root.
Ooh.
And I'm not a beer drinker. I'm a tequila drinker.
like this guy.
During the holidays, his beer is awesome.
Really? So that's ginger root and what was that, raspberry?
Raspberry juice.
That sounds really good.
That sounds good, man. That sounds great.
Yeah. But you guys are talking about flavored beers. I thought, you know, I just throw it in there.
Right? Have them come over.
I think something we haven't.
Maybe I get a bottle from them.
All right, there you go. Thanks, Mike.
Ginger's been put in beer for 500 years.
Yeah. Yeah. The Germans ruined it for everybody else with their purity laws.
Well, purity laws, a good thing.
But presumably, you know, again, 1790s, people would drink whatever was left over that could ferment. They would ferment it and drink it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. Like there wasn't this sort of standard of purity.
Mm-hmm.
It was you had a relatively limited food supply, so you wanted to make sure that everyone was fed, and then whatever happened to be left over, that's what became your alcohol.
Yeah,
and
beer is a nutritional supplement too. I mean, especially in the 17th and 18th century, they're using strong beer to get drunk, but also as you know, like when it's cold and.
Yeah.
You don't have game. You can't grow any vegetables.
Yeah.
It's liquid bread, right? Mm-hmm. It's keeping them alive.
Small beers for younger people. You know,
exactly. Table beer for just drinking. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, and to be clear, we're not recommending that younger people have any kind of beer at all. Johnny Curtin's here, Scott Veltman, and Craig Ravina, and it's the Beer and Spirit Show. The big event is coming up on. Wednesday? Is it?
No. No, not no.
Friday?
That's Ivan.
Saturday the 27th.
Saturday the 27th. Yeah. Deanna Fox is hosting, and you guys will be there talking about the history, the 1790s brewing and distilling scene here in Albany.
Wait, Ray, what is the name of the event?
Proust makes a beer.
Et cetera. Yes. And more, so this one's sold out, but it's part one of, I think, three or four that we're going to do.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So we're going to do 1790s. 1850s.
And then we're going to do like a Dutch one too, right? Yeah. Like an early colonial.
Oh,
Dutch.
So good. That's good.
Yeah, and then like do like 1900 to Prohibition. So we got some good things planned.
Good. A lot of arguments ahead.
Yeah.
Ray and Red Hook. Ray, you're on.
How you doing?
Good.
Great show as usual.
Thank you.
As a previous caller called about the alcohol content in the IPAs. And one of the guys there said 6.4 is a session beer. I'm a New York beer drinker. I go to Taps New York every year. I've been to every one but one. The alcohol content in all the beers are so high. What is like the lowest IPA session beer alcohol content?
I think they were only joking.
Right, yeah.
Three to five.
Yeah.
You can.
For those who don't know, a session beer is made to. It is called a session beer because.
Yeah, you can drink it all day. Yeah. A session.
Okay.
In a session. You know, like if you look at traditional British brewing, you know, prior to the last 10 years or so, it wouldn't have been uncommon to see like an IPA that was 3.5%. And British beer is generally significantly less strong than American beer.
Well, the other thing to consider is that. You know, we're talking about 1790. Transportation was not nearly as easy as it was now. So if you're transporting a 4% beer, you're carrying 96% water around with you.
Yeah,
I mean that's an inefficient.
You make a point.
Yeah.
But liquor, on the other hand.
Well, funny you bring that up. It happens.
Guess that was coming.
Yeah. I know where you're going.
So that was really. I mean, if you go back even further. Liquor was one of the reasons it was popularized. It was essentially a beer concentrate. I mean, whiskey was just a concentrated beer. So you take out all the water, you transport it, and then you water it back down to whatever strength.
It's like meal.
Yeah.
A couple of quick emails here. This one is from Rob. Okay, when I make beer at home, I obsessively sanitize my equipment, ahem, he writes in parentheses, to avoid ruining my brew. What the heck did they have to do in ye olde days?
Probably nothing.
Yeah, probably nothing.
Let's use wild yeast and
stronger luck. Constitutions back then.
Yeah.
I mean, they knew that yeast was the catalyst to make the alcohol.
Yeah.
They didn't have any idea of how that actually happened until the end.
I believe it was magic.
When
did they figure it out?
They thought it was a plant. Not until microbiology comes in at the end of the 19th century. Yeah.
Really?
Really?
And then up till then, it was magic.
Yeah. Until then, it was like they thought it was some sort of plant thing.
When you burn wood, phlogiston comes out.
Yeah.
You know, it's the whole.
Wow. Okay. This one came in from
trolls and gnomes.
This one came in from Daniel. The subject heading, the name Evans. Is the C.H. Evans Brewing Company related to a man named Brown Evans? He used to have a business in Hudson named KAE Data Services. My father knew him. My family business, Mephisto Tool Company, used them for payroll.
We'll say yes.
Are you sure?
No, did they pay you to say any of those names? Neil's on the probably air, listens. By the way.
I just read them.
Neil's probably listening right now. He'll get back to you.
So the actual name Evans goes way back, right?
Yeah. So the guy that owns the pump station now, C.H. Evans, is Cornelius Evans, right?
The third.
And it's his grandfather or great grandfather I think it was Robert Evans bought it.
Okay.
And then Cornelius Evans is his son, and that was in the 1850s, 1860s.
All right, fine. This one is from Allen and Colony. Yuengling Amber Beer claims to be, or Yuengling, claims to be America's oldest brewery. I do like this Pennsylvania product, but I'm wondering what the panel thinks. I also wonder about the water they use, as this beer is made in rural coal Pennsylvania country. What do you think, Yuengling?
It's the oldest brewery in the country.
It is beer.
I've had a few.
Yeah.
They're all right.
I've seen it on the shelf.
Yeah. No, back in the day, we had them, and there's nothing wrong with that. I liked it. I like Schaefer back in the day.
Yeah, right.
Yingling was, I mean, not that they're a pioneer, but they had black and tan before. Yeah. That was
they sure did. Yeah. I think they still do to this day.
And I think they still have the porter out too. I think that's
the Chesterfield porter. Is that right?
No, that's old Chesterfield ale. I think they just make a Yingling porter. But I think that's why Budweiser made that, or Anheuser-Busch made that post-prohibition beer was to compete with Yingling. Yeah.
Really? After all these years? Really?
No,
that doesn't make sense.
I think they're taking that long.
They're starting to feel a pinch. They are. Yeah. I mean, they had it so easy for so long.
I mean, I don't have any evidence on that. I'm purely speculating.
Wow. I'm not surprised. And it was great. It was great having you guys here.
Classic
today.
Craig.
We've learned a lot.
Once again.
Learned a lot.
Lies.
The big event is coming up on Thursday. It is a Proust and, what is it called and when is it?
It is called Proust, a Brewed and Boozy Sampling of 1790s Albany. It is at Tenbroke Mansion. We will be there in costume. Two out of three of us will be in costume.
What are you going to dress up as?
Colonial cool guys.
I was going to bring the banana suit.
Deanna Fox will be moderating it, and this is in conjunction with Discover Albany, Savor Albany. If you want more information about all the cool things that they have coming up in 2018, www.albany.org/restaurants.
Well done. You're a real professional. Johnny Curtin, how do we find out more about your venue?
Ravina.
I mean, if you want to come hear how wrong Craig is about things, I'll be at Slingerland's Wine and Spirits tonight.
Oh, really?
4 to 7. Oh, doing I love some that samplings. Place. Yeah, so come on by, say hello. Yeah.
Okay.
Or Johnny's just, a hack. Yeah.
And, these two are real trouble. Scott, how do we find out more about what you do?
Go to evansdale.com. We're always up to date on our website. And stop on down on Saturdays.
Well, this was, I can't say it was fun, but it's done. So thank you, and good luck with the event coming up. And you can find out more about that by going to the website that Craig mentioned several times. Thanks again to Craig Ravina, Johnny Curtin, and Scott Veltman for being here of the Albany Ale Project. Thank you for listening. Support comes from Spirit House, Amherst, Massachusetts, a family-owned wine, beer, and spirits retailer offering organically farmed wines from around the world. Wine tastings Saturday afternoons, spirithaus.com. Gloriosa & Company, hosting weddings at the Curtis House in Ashfield, Massachusetts, with on-site guest accommodations, local floral design, and weekly summer flower CSA shares also available, gloriosaco.com. And Big Y, family-owned and operated with Big Y Express stations in Lee and Pittsfield, celebrating more than 80 years of serving communities throughout New England, BigY.com. Thanks again to Craig, Johnny, and Scott for being here. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Thanks to, that's not Barb King, that's Joe Makowitz, who answered the phones. Well done. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Have a lovely weekend. Alan will be back in the big chair Monday morning at 2. No, Monday, not Monday morning. He'll be here at Monday morning at 2. It'll be Monday afternoon at 2 for a Medical Monday. Have a good weekend. Stand by now for news.